Welcome to another episode of This Catholic Life. Conversations about life's ups and downs, big and small, how we deal with every situation imaginable, whatever life throws at us, but still manage to be sensible, practical, and joyful. Today's show is Gaming for Life, a conversation about gaming, whether it's for fun, for good, whether it involves beauty, whether it's a waste of time, the moral dimensions of gaming, and the good of games in themselves. Before we get started, you can find the details regarding This Catholic Life podcast and how to contact us on our website, thiscatholiclife.com.au. You can find us on iTunes, Spotify, all the usual podcast apps. If you would like to support us, you can subscribe on your favourite podcasting app of choice. You can help us out especially by leaving a review on iTunes. Please do that. Write a review. Don't just leave us the 5 stars. That helps other people discover the podcast more easily. I'm your host, Peter Holmes, and today I'm joined by Ryan Galliott, our artist, resident geek, and co-host today.
Hello.
And by Tara Van Ness, who describes herself as a student of law, a philosopher, and a dabbler in the world of gaming. Hello, Tara.
Good morning, Peter.
Thank you for joining us today. Let's dive right into today's topic, gaming for life. We should begin by defining what we're talking about here. Box, what do we mean by gaming?
Gaming. Ooh. I guess it pertains to play, right? Just play. Enjoyment.
Yeah. Fun. It's interesting with playing. Does that mean it has to have rules? It's an interesting thing, isn't it? Like, have you ever seen the comic strip Kelvin and Hobbes?
Yes.
There's a game that he plays called Kelvin Ball, and the only rule is you have to change the rules every time you play, which sounds a lot like my kids.
Still a rule, though.
It is a rule. That's very good.
I think there has to be rules to some degree to play a game that we've structured in a way.
Right.
Makes us different from how, say, animals would play.
Yeah. Right.
Well, I mean, I was just recently watching Big Bang Theory, and Sheldon was talking about if there are no rules, there's no point to the game.
It's interesting that you say if there's no rules. Now, it's possible to play a game and not have winners and losers.
Mm.
So you can just play a game, like a word game, or you can toss things back
and
forth.
But is that a rule, Peter, if you don't have winners or losers?
It's interesting. In fact, most schools now, they say everyone's a winner. My son came home from school on sports day once and very angry. And I said, didn't you have sports today? And he said, yes. What did you do? Softball. Oh, well, don't you like sport? Yes. What's wrong? They said it didn't matter who won. I had to talk to the teacher who was saying, no, we don't want anyone to win. The boys in the group were particularly annoyed about the fact that it didn't matter. Even when they lost, it mattered to them who had won. They needed to know where they stood. It's an interesting thing about gaming. Let's be honest, this is a big topic. It covers so many different kinds of play, and it's not just play for little children. It's gaming for adults, and this is a big deal nowadays. It's becoming commercialized, but we've always actually played games as adults.
Mm. Well, I know, as we've spoken about before, I've done my thesis on gaming.
Right.
And the common reaction I had from a lot of people is that I cannot believe the university is allowing you to waste its time talking about video games or gaming in general.
Yes.
It's seen as such a triumph to constantly being busy and to be working that games and that part of our lives seems to be something that is just fallen by the wayside.
It's interesting. I was reading a book by a counselling team about relationships, and one of the key emotional needs of people is recreational companionship, actually having someone to play with.
Mm-hmm.
It might be a hobby. You know, some people think it's very serious. They collect stamps or they collect something or they're into music or they... But all of these hobbies are a form of things we don't get paid for. They're recreational. Mm-hmm. It's a kind of game, really.
Yeah, a form of play.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, why do we play? What is this weirdness thing? Now, some animals play in terms of just muck around with things, but humans seem to have these rules which define our play. Going back, way back in history, some of the earliest archaeological digs unveiled board games, like a quite a strange game, and then archaeologists are trying to figure out how to play it, of course, and there's whole websites dedicated to what the rules of this particular weird game are. But as early as history, we've been developing ways to play. Now, one of the main reasons early on was to teach people either intellectual development, so strategy games, such as chess, for example, which is a strategy war game. It's actually a role-playing game because they've got the queen who's a sorceress and all the others who've got these amazing powers. Otherwise, she couldn't move the way she did.
Mm.
but all sorts of other games are developed. So, for example, young boys and girls have always played at soldier. you know, played at these things, which were actually skills that were then very quickly developed, unfortunately, into real life.
Do you think there's something deeper going on, though, other than just being educational with
Absolutely
play?
There is, yeah. There is something deeper in terms of play. It's not just working on skills, for example. It is, in fact, role-playing, if you like, playing out a particular role. When I pretended to be the knight who came and rescued, you know, his friends who'd been stuck by the bad guy, that's not just me working out some skills of hacking with a sword. I haven't had to use swords very much in adult life. But it actually is the whole idea, playing out in my own mind, the whole idea of being the hero or being the person who comes to the situation where there's good and evil struggle. And we talked about in the superheroes episode that kind of role play, if you like, even while we're watching someone else role play it, there's a kind of a playing out of the whole universal struggle of good and evil, but also some of the struggles of ourself, our internal struggles.
Yeah. Mm. It's interesting. I mean, just to extrapolate from that a bit more, talking about the Olympic Games and, you know, the nature that, I mean, the common belief is that came about instead of war, we had these games.
Right.
In order to have that sort of...
To have it out instead of having it out in warfare.
It's a more peaceful way. Yeah, yeah. And I think there is that correlation between gaming and play and the social construct, I guess, of standing and of finding ways to get along.
I think, though, if I can push back on that one a little bit, the Olympics are interesting, and I watch them every time they come up on 4 years. But I have to say, track and field, I watch, you know, maybe the 100 meter, and then the rest of it, you go, they're running.
Yeah,
you know, it's. I mean, I understand as they've
seen
invested
before.
Their whole life on this, but it's interesting that you can see someone who doesn't run as fast, but who happens to be really good at running with a ball and crunching into the other guy, and there's an actual physical contest of some kind, and they have to play within the rules and get the ball in the net or whatever it is. We're much more drawn as spectators to a kind of a gladiatorial game, you know, like
some kind of contest,
test of skill and strength.
Yeah, well, it's interesting that a lot of people think that we haven't moved on very far from the gladiatorial times.
We don't put the other team with a sword at the end of the game.
Yes, but in terms of our bloodlust in football games or soccer games, I think there's still an appeal going on there to some degree.
Yeah. I think you're right. I mean, even though AFL, for example, I'm an AFL fan, have really toned down the violence. Like, you can't do certain things. You're not allowed to hit them in the head. You're not allowed to hit them below the knees. There's all kinds of rules to protect the players from being damaged. But the video clips which go overseas and all the Americans look at are the ones that, you know, the 10 greatest head
tackles,
clashes in AFL.
The greatest punch-ups on the field.
And I've tried so hard. I'm just going to get me in trouble with our audience, but I've tried so hard to get into NRL. I've tried so hard, and I've played touch, and I enjoy playing touch with friends. But I just the appeal of it just isn't the same as some of the more complex rules in AFL, I think. And I still think there's a lot more skill individually in running around, and there's mayhem in AFL than there is in the NRL. That's going to get me in a lot of trouble. I appreciate that, but. Coming back to board games, lots of popular games out there are deliberately modelled on life. So, for example, Monopoly. I can't play Monopoly. It's far too tediously modelled on life. And the way it grinds down the other players.
You don't need that horrible reminder of how much you owe the bank,
exactly.
Do you, Peter?
and the fact that the whole aim of it is to grind down the other players. It's just it's a malicious thing. And it's funny, I can't handle that. But when I play a game called Trouble, I don't know if you've ever played...
Trouble.
Where you literally just go around the board bomb.
You push a thing in the middle and the dice spins up.
That's right. Yeah. And if you land on someone else, they have to go back to base. We have a specialised version in our house. We call it Holmes Rules, where you can go backwards to bomb and you can go around again if you want to bomb people. And it's basically this getting everybody, getting everyone else. And it's hilarious because it's just a trivial game and everyone has a go and it's kind of fun.
Maybe there's something deeper going on there with your thoughts to capitalism in Monopoly and its crushing of the individual soul.
Well, it's interesting. We have a game called Pol Economy, which is based on Australian stock market, and it includes complex things like government, inflation, things like that. I think it's out of print now, but... the game itself, we love playing, and partially it's that it's possible to succeed without it costing other players. So it's possible for people to get to a higher level of wealth without having to grind down the other people.
interesting. So developed upon a more perhaps morally good idea of money and how we work together as a society.
Well, I don't know if moral. I don't know if obtaining huge amounts of money is moral. But
maybe we'll cut that out.
No, that's a good point. I just think that the actual exercise of grinding someone else down to win is not something I'm happy with. That's why I can't watch boxing. I don't think boxing is a sport. Lots of people disagree with me on that. I'm quite happy to take that on board. But when boxing, and especially the newer stuff, the cage fighting sort of stuff, it seems to be grinding down the opponent in a way that the purpose of the sport is to actually cause them harm in some way.
And I think that is reflected a lot in modern gaming, computer games and otherwise.
So when you play against other players online, you mean?
I've got a party of other Catholic males, actually, and we usually go on, we play games, and we use that as a platform in which, while we're just grinding away doing whatever in the game, we discuss what's happening in our lives, what happened today.
Yep.
And it's really funny because we were split halfway, 50-50. Two of the four guys that we catch up regularly with, they loved player versus player. So they loved the coming head to head.
Yep.
And myself and this other guy we didn't like that at all.
Right.
We liked what's called, PVE. And
just
it's more
player versus environment.
Yeah, environment. And
we better pause at this point to define these things. So what we're talking about here is online gaming. So once I got married, I couldn't go out and play cricket and football anymore. So I did a lot of my social interaction by sitting at home on a computer. But you put a headset on and you've got a microphone. You can talk live to other players while interacting with them in a game situation.
Yeah.
And so this is the player. Sometimes that is playing against a bad guy or an environment that's generated by the computer, and you team up to beat the dragon or whatever it is.
Yeah.
Or sometimes it's pitting your skills against another online player. So we call that PvP, player versus player, or PvE, which is against the environment. So go on.
And it was an interesting aspect to really confront, because you could see the way that we dealt with and seemed to be attracted to conflict.
Right.
In that way. I think for myself, I've lived a particular life where I've had to deal with a lot of conflict.
Right.
Being out there and being a missionary in the past. And so when I play my games, I don't want to deal with that conflict with another player. I'd rather take out the bad guys, the aliens, the zombies.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Yeah. I love the team play. Of not just this kind of game, but also tabletop gaming when you're on the same team as other people in a tabletop game.
That's a lot of cooperative gaming,
that's the word. But I have to say, after a really hard week at the office when there's people I'd like to have strangled, there's nothing better than getting into a player versus player game and just mashing it.
Can we just pause there for a second, though, and just bring it back to your boxing point about you not liking grinding with another player right down? Mm. Is that not the same? And you said it's not really a game in your perspective. Yeah. Is that not analogous to what you're talking about?
It is, and you're right. That's an inconsistency in my logic. I think that you could actually say that that's a game, and that, in fact, a lot of the way people play player versus player online is about grinding the other person down, even in their self-esteem. And there's all sorts of actions they call griefing online, where you actually maliciously make it hard for the other person to enjoy the game.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I guess I'm drawing the line, and you're right. I shouldn't have said it's not a sport, because it clearly is. But when the purpose of football is to kick the ball through the goals or get it across the line or kick it into the net or whatever it is, it's good game when they go hard at it physically, but the purpose isn't to hurt the other person.
Okay.
So I guess I'm drawing a distinction there.
Maybe we could just talk about what do you think is the purpose of gaming?
Yeah.
Is it to win? Is it to play? Enjoy yourself?
Do you want to spin that out a little bit? I think all of those are true, but let's talk about how each one of them might be true.
How it might play out. Mm. Well, I think there's a problem if someone's playing just for the sake of winning.
Right.
Because then it becomes about your pleasure and your feeling about winning, and you can't enjoy the game for its own sake.
Yes.
And if winning becomes an end in of itself, I think what's the point of playing a game in that
you become prepared to sacrifice all the other goods involved in the game in order to get to the one good winning.
Sacrifice the friendship.
Yeah.
Or,
yeah.
the sociability aspect
and
of
your self-respect, because some people can win but they don't have the respect of their teammates or the opposition.
If you would say, maybe I think play is at the end of the game,
right,
ultimately, because we have this desire to engage in a basic good of play. And what I mean by that is there are certain self-evident things that are good for human beings, and one of them is play.
So are you in the camp that says everyone's a winner? You give everyone a trophy?
No, I'm not. I think part of enjoying play is learning how to lose graciously.
Very good, yes. Very good. Yes, losing graciously
and
is,
and it makes,
in fact,
victory all that much sweeter.
It does. I played in a cricket team. I think I've mentioned this before. I played in a cricket team that lost about three seasons, every game for three seasons. And then eventually we developed ourselves and we came up right up to A grade, in fact. But it's just that learning to lose graciously is actually a huge part of being able to win. As you say, it makes victory sweeter, but it also it helps us learn how to win properly.
Yeah.
Because if winning is just about dominating the other person, that's not winning.
No.
That's actually about an ego clash.
Well, it's interesting because I'm going back to video games because that's my forte.
Yeah, sure. I mean, there's a lot we can unpack. Yes. Let's go back to video games.
Sorry, yeah. No, just on that, the topic there, I mean, I would play this game called Battlefield 1. My friends and I play, and this is a player versus player game, but it's such a big field. It's 64 players.
Wow.
And the way you win is that there are these checkpoints or these points that you have to hold throughout the map, and each team has to, I guess, conquer.
It's capture the flag.
Capture the flag, but there are 5 points and 5 flags. And there's a terminology, there's a term that's been, I guess it's become more popular now, called play the freaking objective, PTFO. And
in other words, play for the markers for winning rather than something
and
else.
I found that, I think that's what attracts me to play, is that there is that organized aspect of it. And why I can play that as a player versus player section game is that I can focus on these objectives. And we can win, and it has to play within the rules. You have to play, you know, within the scope of the game and the idea. It isn't about just going out there and killing everyone, which you could do in that game. But my friends and I would pretty much always win if our team, at least our squad of 5 people, focused on playing the objective.
Can I come back to that, though? What's underlying that team of 5, is that your interaction with them. What does gaming actually do to me as a person? What are the skills that I bring out? Like, so for instance, when I played as a team, the majority of playing as a team socially was the social aspect that you find out something about yourself when you win when you lose, but also your contribution to the team. Now, people aren't necessarily going to judge you. I mean, if you've got a super skillful player, they'll often be popular. But the people who are most popular are the ones we know are trying their absolute guts out for their team. Yeah. And they're playing for the team, not for their own glory.
Is this in a video game, sorry?
It's in everything. Yeah. So in football, the guys who are the most, you know, the best and fairest kind of guys in the club were almost always the guys who just gave everything to the team. And they played for the team. Mm. And they call a team man. But you have the same in online gaming. There's people who are in it for the individual glory and the ones who want to get all the kills, etc. And there's the others who are prepared to play a self-sacrificial role in order for the team to win. And they're the kind of people that really make it fun.
Well, I found that with our group, I mean, we played pretty much every night just for an hour or two. And you find that after all these years of playing, even without communication, we would start to fill in each other's weaknesses. So if one game I was a better player at doing a particular role.
Yep.
The others, even though they want to play other, you know, roles, they will fill in roles that support me in my gaming.
Right.
And then if we switch game to something else, it would be the same way otherwise, you know.
This comes up in role-playing game a lot. You have to actually, you can't be everything. So if you're playing a tabletop role-playing game, there are different people who have to play different things. Now, we need to quickly address.
Maybe we could just clarify quickly as well, different types of role-playing. So you have cooperative role-playing games, tabletop gaming that is actually in person. You sit around together. Mm-hmm. You also have cooperative gaming online.
Yes.
And you also have role-playing games where you play individually.
Sure.
Yes. So maybe just to clarify.
Yeah, individual role-playing games usually involve a computer game of some kind.
Mm-hmm.
Tabletop gaming means that you don't have a computer usually. You're basically just talking and it's working through things. Now, what's interesting is I'm seeing role-playing coming up a lot more in education now. Like in classrooms, they use role-playing quite a bit to teach skills to work. And we just had a workshop professional development workshop at work, and we had to role play certain scenarios to actually work things out. And some people in the past have suggested that role playing is, you know, you can't do this, this is not Christian. And ironically, one of them said to a friend of mine, what would Jesus do? Would he role play? And you go, well, technically asking the question, what would Jesus do, is role-playing.
The irony. Yeah. I think we should hash this out a lot, actually.
Go ahead.
I think it's a really big topic within Catholics and Christians in general that I've had conversations with about role-playing. There seems to be this idea that taking on personas, especially if that persona involves actions they perceive to be evil.
Yes.
That is doing damage to yourself.
Yeah.
And that it's a immoral way to engage in play by taking on a role play. So maybe we could hash that out a little bit, because
is that similar to people acting in a movie? Like, say, for instance, Heath Ledger did an absolutely magnificent job of playing the Joker.
Yes.
But there's a lot of discussion about how much it affected him as a person.
Yeah.
Yes, there
and
is.
So playing out an evil role, for example.
What that does to you.
Yeah. One of the games I play online, or used to play online when I had some time, was the Star Wars game, where you could either play the hero sort of Jedi or the Sith. And if you play the Sith, you actually kind of have to make bad decisions.
You do. Yeah. You have to kill your master.
That's right. Yeah. And it's just really quite, and it's interesting. It rewards you. And there's a lot of studies being done into the effect of having to make decisions and those decisions having consequences in games.
Yes.
And it actually forms you in a certain way. There's actually a virtue being developed or a vice. And that's an interesting question.
Well, yeah. I think it's interesting to point out, though, even in these role-playing games where we do take on an evil persona, we still have an internal logic to the game that we can't escape from reality. So it's not like we can just make evil decisions and then everything in the game works out really well for us. Otherwise, I don't think we're willing to suspend our disbelief in the in the game. Yeah. So I think when you actually take on an evil persona, bad things happen to you in that game.
Right.
And I think you actually have a deeper awareness of what evil looks like by taking on a persona.
Mm.
I think people extrapolate from that to an nth degree. I mean, there's that common, I would say, myth of that video games beget violence.
Ooh, here we go.
you did not open that can of worms.
Oh, yes, I did.
You know, there's been lots of studies on this, and what they've demonstrated is that they don't actually create violence in someone, but what they can demonstrate is that first-person violence, so if you first-person, that means that you're looking into the computer screen as if you're looking out of your own eyes in the game, first-person violence of an explicit nature does in fact desensitize the player to violence. And so while it wouldn't necessarily make them want to be violent, when they were confronted with an accident or a disaster of some kind, they weren't able to empathize with someone else's disaster.
I think that's a definite distinction that has to be made. The desensitization can lead to you know, that end, but it doesn't equal, you know, the causation of the violence. You know, it doesn't make someone want to go out and... I mean, I've been playing games all my life. I'm 37 now.
Right.
There you go. Just gave it away. and I can't say that... I mean, hopefully you guys can attest to this. I'm not a violent person.
No.
And
I don't know. I've seen these black outrageous boxes.
Yeah. So.
Do you know that one of the studies on violence in computer games, they work through anger coming from computer games, and the number one cause, do you know what the number one cause for violence as in violent reactions to computer games was?
The frustration of the games?
The frustration with controllers.
Yes.
That you can't actually transmit what you want to do. So it was actually a frustration with the interaction, the device that you're interacting with. And so if you can't make the keyboard do what you want it to do or something, not with the actual game mechanics.
It's interesting because when we were running around as kids waving a stick around as a sword, that thing represents the sword. And we can.
Yep.
And so we've swapped it over for a controller that can mimic something a lot more clearer within a game.
All right.
But so then how do we, I guess that's what you're saying, that the frustration of how this translates to a game.
I think it might be really helpful if we draw some distinctions between the content of types of games. So I think you could say some games are more conducive to the proper end of play than others.
Yeah.
Which may also have something to do with whether it desensitizes you to violence and things like that. And also you have to, I think, really take into consideration the Delphi Oracle's maxim of know thyself.
Yes,
know thyself. And I think that comes into play in anything that
so,
we
so what you mean in. There is, correct me if I'm wrong here, but what you're saying is there be very aware of what gaming does to you.
Yes,
and I think what it brings out in you.
Yeah.
Yes, but I think also on a deeper level in general, we should try and know what our faults are.
Okay.
And I think in a way, I was thinking about this last night before coming onto the podcast. For example, if someone has an addictive personality,
sure,
and they get addicted to gaming,
right,
it's really easy for us to say gaming is bad, gaming is very addictive. But in a sense, I think the game is sort of accidental to what's really going on, and this person has something else,
yes,
that needs to be addressed.
It's an avoidance behaviour, or it's a complex.
It
set
is.
Of
so
circumstances.
If we have violent tendencies already going on, and then we love the violent video games, and maybe that exacerbates it. But I think something deeper needs to be addressed.
That's right.
Sure, and a distinction needs to be made. For example, I mean, if I'm had a rough week, running a hard game of soccer out or a hard game of touch or something like that actually is really good for me to let the frustrations out.
Yes.
And it doesn't mean I'm a violent person. It just means it's good to sort of release that sort of tension in that way.
Mm.
Can I pull back to the question you said about kids gaming with the sword in the backyard?
Yeah.
Most people look at that with a big smile and go, isn't that wonderful? The kids are playing. When they see adults playing games, they go, seriously, guys, have you not grown up? And the average age of a gamer right now, a computer gamer, that is 37.
Yes.
So
there you go, Box.
Yes. I mean, back in 2015, it already said 33.
So it's following your age.
It's following my age. I'm like, wow,
something,
you know, I'm the average gamer.
Born in your age bracket.
And what's even more interesting is that the average age of someone paying to play games is slightly older than that again.
Mm-hmm.
So in terms of the market's following the money. And so the money that is there in that sense. And often board games now are pitching more and more towards adult levels as well. So the whole idea of adults gaming has been critiqued a lot lately. And the implication is that adults should be getting on with doing things that are serious, like working or developing a career or studying or doing all these things. So let's talk about adults gaming. And whether, and I'm not just talking about me as a father joining in with my child's game as an act of, you know, parenting and fun. What about me playing a game as an adult?
Yeah. I mean, I was looking at some of that research, and I've got, I guess we'll put this in the show notes later on. But one of the things mentioned in one of the surveys said that there was a large percentage of people that play games in order to keep their brains active.
Ooh.
And these weren't just young people. These were...
So this is puzzle games, though, you're talking about?
I don't know if they're puzzle games or not. It just said that they play games. And I remember there was an article about some 90-something-year-old grandma who goes off and plays Call of Duty, which is a first-person shooter, you know. And she says that she first got into it because her grandson wanted to play it with her, but now she actually plays because it keeps her active.
Right.
I would love it if she was better than him.
I would not be surprised.
It's so funny. When my son started playing World of Warcraft, for example, and I played it, it was so funny the moment at which his reflexes got better than mine.
Mm.
As in, I was actually quite high in the player versus player stakes and used to play Arena and all sorts of stuff and lead raids. And then he suddenly was just much better than me. And I'm like,
yeah.
It was an interesting sort of thing.
Yeah. Maybe we'll come back to World of Warcraft because I feel like that's another whole can of worms that we should open up. So with people keeping their minds active playing games, it's really interesting because we do tend to have a lot of jobs that I think are mundane, boring. And I think boredom itself is a really interesting phenomenon that's going on in our lives that needs to be addressed.
But you can be bored even if your brain's active though. For example, I'm working in
you
a university.
Bored now?
No, I love this. This is great. It's not a game though, which is interesting. I work in a university, so my brain's going overtime and I'm not a person who can just sit and veg at the end of the day. I need my brain to go somewhere else to be relaxed.
Yeah.
And so games take me somewhere else. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Even if it's like we just bought a game, a really old classic game called Pass the Pig, which is as simple as throwing these two model pigs on a table and seeing how they land. And it's simple enough for the kids to get into and it's an uproarious fun when you're playing it. But every night my daughter comes in, my youngest daughter, got to play it. So we play this uproarious game and it's about just taking you somewhere else other than your occupation.
Mm.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, I play role-playing games. I injured my back a long time ago.
It's
just a background for the listeners. And so I can't be very physically active.
Right.
And I play role-playing games to explore that physical activity. I guess, you know, I can't learn a lot of the same things doing a physical sport and things like that, you know, in terms of team play, because I don't have access to it.
Right.
But I'm currently playing a role-playing game, and I'm able to do certain things with my character who has abilities and skills that I don't have.
Sure.
And just like reading a novel, which, by the way, I love reading, I'm not ignoring that, but this is a way that I can actually step into and participate in a fantasy setting or whatever. And
the word immersive.
Immerse myself and learn things that I would not normally learn in real life.
It's
broadened my horizons because I'm presented with elements, with situations and encounters that force me to make a decision and to act.
Sure.
And I have to live with the consequences.
So let me explore that a little bit. The whole, it's not just you get to be different. Also, the scenario is different. So, yes. For example, in my life, about as heroic as it gets at the moment, is there's a cockroach and my wife says, deal with it, and I squash it. And it just doesn't have the same reward as when I've killed the dragon. You know?
That's right. That's right.
Stand there on top of the cockroach, look at me. Anyway, the point is that you can be in scenarios where the good and evil are so clear. And the struggle, if you like, is quite a clear struggle. Some games, we've mentioned, actually aren't that clear. So the role-playing ones actually engage us in quite complex character interactions.
Yes.
And they're kind of fun because you get to step out of your own shoes. And in a certain sense, I think it builds empathy because if you have the capacity to step out of your own shoes and think in the shoes of someone else,
yes.
That's a skill that you can apply to real life. What would I feel if I were in their shoes?
That's true. And it's also interesting, I find, in role-playing games when you are making decisions for someone that you are not naturally predisposed to make decisions like, you get to a point where you realize you're not that far away from that character in many respects. And it's kind of it is kind of frightening. And I think it does make you develop empathy with people because you realize you're only a few bad decisions away from becoming the person you don't want to be.
Yes.
And that's why I think they can be really helpful in illustrating how hard it is to walk the line of virtue.
Yep. So the anti-hero in movies, we've talked about that a bit, it often pushes this line.
Yes.
Yeah, the difference between the anti-hero and the hero is only a couple of bad decisions or a couple of bad motives or something like that.
Yes.
And as you say, we can see in ourselves something, whoops, what if we went there? What
it's
if
true.
That happened?
But on the flip side of that, I heard someone talking about, I can't remember who it was, Tolkien, and about why Lord of the Rings is so amazing. And all of the nine are heroes. And he was saying, well, it's actually very difficult to write the hero character as well because it's so hard to be a hero. Mm. And if you actually try and role play as the hero, it's not that clear cut either how you make decisions and you're faced with really hard choices.
Which is like real life.
It is like real life. Yes, it might be played out in a fun fantasy world, but maybe it's, dare I say, a safe space to play things out and see how you can get it wrong.
Well, Calvin and Hobbes, coming back to that comic again by Bill Watterson, explores this a little bit and says, why are comic book bad guys so, you know, stereotypical? Why are the heroes always, you know, why is it always good versus evil? And Hobbes, who's named after the philosopher Hobbes, comes back to Calvin and says, yeah, we should have real life bad guys. You know, you could sit on committees and and Calvin says, I think I see the problem.
Yeah.
and Hobbes, the last caption is Hobbes saying, quick, to the bat facts. Real life is grind. Like, it's really boring. Like sending an email to the parliament over something, or sending an email to my boss, or gently suggesting something in a committee meeting isn't the same as throwing my sword up and running into battle kind of thing.
I don't know. I think sometimes when you, I don't want to say you're crossing the distinction between fantasy and reality, but I think fantasy can really inspire and make your reality colourful if you allow your imagination to run with it. And I know myself in past experience, I've been sitting in before going to an exam and you've got all the nervous energy in the university happening and you just think to yourself sometimes, well, I do anyway, it feels like you're going to go fight a dragon.
Yes.
And it makes the whole experience of walking into the exam fun.
Yes.
Yeah. Like a game, and you can do it.
If you can envisage, that's actually, you know, a psychological technique to envisage the opposition or the obstacle as if it were something to be defeated and taken on in that respect.
It's a challenge.
Yeah, that made it fun for me. But I would just like to bring it back to what you were saying earlier, Box, about how you can't do a lot of things because of your back, and then you can explore it in the game. What about the objection saying, well, it's actually taking you further away from reality in that sense, so you're immersing yourself in something that's not real?
Yeah. I think it goes back to something you said earlier, which is know thyself and know the limits of what you're capable of and what you should really be doing. I mean, one thing that it really helped me do playing role-playing is I had to play a character once that was very charming, that got along with everyone, and that pushed me to go out of my skin, and I learned how to actually transplant that into real life. Now, that actually didn't take me away from real life. That actually helped me to enter into it more fully.
Mm. So there, in real life, we actually sort of live up to expectations of ourselves. Right. Like we have a persona that we think we are.
It's true.
And sometimes pushing us outside that can actually develop.
When you have to channel your inner extrovert at a conference.
But I mean, if you look at a lot of famous people, let's say Stephen Colbert, Vin Diesel, they attribute a lot of what they've been able to do publicly to the fact that they learned how to get along with people and how to socialize through their role-playing games in the past.
Interesting. What about the typical stereotypical gamer who is really awkward, can't hold a conversation with you because
very
he's
unfit.
constantly plugged in to games.
Yeah. And that is the danger. That is, I mean, as with so many things in life now, and what you mentioned earlier, addiction. You know, it becomes gaming addiction, and that's usually just a symptom of a deeper underlying problem.
So coming back to World of Warcraft, as you requested, one of the studies in from a Scandinavian university studied in the UK and in Scandinavia, 1 in 9 players of World of Warcraft exhibited at least 3 of the markers of addiction. So in terms of the World of Warcraft is an online game. It's probably the most commonly played one. It's one of the big ones. At its peak, I think it had 13 million subscribers. It's nowhere near that now. But some of the online games like World of Tanks have, you know, 60, 70 million players in them. And they're freemium, which means they're free to play, but you can pay extra to get a winning edge. Whereas World of Warcraft, you pay and you simply play it. Yeah. But in the game itself, it has little addictive things. So all the colors are primary colors for starters. Which is catches your eye. You get little rewards. Every time you achieve one little thing, you get a little reward. And this micro-reward system has been demonstrated to be a form of like just enticing you into the game. And there's also other things such as loot boxes that you mentioned earlier, Box. Loot boxes are where you get something that has a random thing in it. And it might be a really cool thing or it might be just something small. And it's actually been... Did you say it's been...
Yeah, well, loot boxes are these things where you pay real-world money for a chest or something in the world that might even just be a cosmetic addition to your character, so it doesn't add anything, or it might be a world-ending weapon, you know? And,
it's a form of gambling, though,
isn't it? A form of gambling, which is why it was recently, just this year in 2019, taken to court. I can't remember where, but it was an internationally watched... For the fact that it is gambling.
Right.
And a company, EA, has actually come out and said, it wasn't gambling, it's surprise mechanics.
you gave us money for nothing.
Well, the thing is, so many kids have spent hundreds of thousands of dollars of their parents' money on these loot boxes.
And a lot of this, I mentioned the word freemium before, a lot of these things, it's like the age-old mechanic of when the drug dealer gave you the first one free and it sort of suckered you into the world. So freemium games, you download them and you can play them to a certain extent.
Gateway drugs.
And then suddenly, I mean, and I play a lot of freemium games because they're free, or I used to. But once you actually get to a certain point in the game, you really can't progress at the same rate as anyone else who's paying money. So that draws you in to paying more money. Now, of course, they have the mechanic is for them to make money. That's the way they can be online. But what about... ugly gaming. Now, we've talked about addiction. There's also the issue of violence. There's actual murders attributed to World of Warcraft frustration. So players who knew each other in real life had a disappointing outcome in terms of the game, and several in the States and a couple in China. There's been some suicides. There's one fellow in Korea, I think, who literally played himself to death. He played 40 straight hours of StarCraft and died of a heart attack. His otherwise healthy young man died of a heart attack.
There's
being in the
chair. There's also another, a really, really tragic case. I think it was in Korea where a couple who had a baby were gaming to a point where they forgot to feed the baby and it passed away. Yeah. And it's just an absolute tragedy.
So clearly it's something that needs to be managed in all mature lives, play has a small place in terms of not just recreation, but learning. Yeah. Also, the fact that we can have fun as humans is one of the things that sets us aside from the animals in terms of being able to enter into a different kind of exploration of an imagination. But it needs to be done within proper reason. And one of the things that my study is in masculinity, one of the things that keeps coming up is that young men in particular, and I'm not saying young women don't have this, but when I'm looking at young men, they have a particular drive to succeed. And when it's completely invested in computer gaming or in some other form of like sport or something like that, then basically it's not going anywhere that we would normally call constructive. Mm-hmm. It's not going to relationships, to family, to work, to study, anything like that.
Just a quick note on that. Actually, something's really interesting. I don't know how true this is, but I did read it, that apparently with men who have invested all this time into gaming for shooter games like Call of Duty, they've actually been contacted by American military, tried to get them to join because they're actually so good. And then they want to get them to use drones.
Right.
Yeah.
Because that's the changing nature of our warfare.
I think that's where it's going to go, because if you have someone who's very, very skilled at operating a machine that way, then of course you put them in charge of something like that.
Well, I remember, I think in the early 2000s, I signed up for this game called America's Army. And they didn't even bother hiding the fact, this is back when I had a PC.
Yep.
They didn't bother hiding the fact that this was a game made by the American military. And they actually would recruit the highest
That's something similar to what I was reading about.
People are using games for training now. So police and military use games like hostage situations, games, virtual reality. There's also games. I've actually played some of the games that are used to train jet pilots. Now, I've not actually flown a jet, but I've crashed a 747 in the games many times. And I have a full, joystick and everything's what's called HOTAS, hands-on throttle and stick, set up at home.
You're really revealing how much of a nerd you are here, PR.
I haven't used it since I've done the PhD. But the whole...
some might say that's the virtuous choice.
Indeed. Some might.
I think that's the balance. I mean, we look at the goods of human, being a human person. I think the good of play should never overcome another good, which, the good of health.
Mm.
There needs to be that balance.
In fact, it's supposed to serve it, really.
Yes. Yeah.
And so that's just it. Addiction is something that comes around so many areas of our lives now.
Sure.
And gaming is definitely something that can be addictive.
So what would you say to an AFL player or an NRL player or a soccer player or someone who has given their whole life, at this stage at least, people who are running around kicking a ball for a living is what I'm talking about. I love watching the sport, and it's a spectator sport. It's designed to sell advertising, really, because it gets you watching and then they can sell advertising. But what is it that they've actually put their lives into? Often the players will talk about the development of their character through sport, the fact that they've learned so much about life through playing the sport.
And that's just it. I think there's a hit there. When we talk about drugs, people will say, I'm just waiting for my next hit. When you see a good in something, we desire it, and so when they see how much it's changed them for the good, there's something in it that they like. But how much is too much?
Mm.
I mean, it's they're that good because they've devoted their lives to it.
Yeah.
But how much of their life should they devote to it?
It's an interesting question, but I think in a charitable reading of it, there's room for excellence in all areas, and I think you could ask the same question of someone being excellent at playing the piano, or someone who is at the height of their career as an academic.
Sure.
How much time have they devoted into this good? And I think there is room for that. And it's
absolutely
okay. We need people of excellence in sports.
That's right. What's interesting, though, is that when I actually went into thinking about this and talked about sports players, the sports players invest, and I thought, gee, they invest all their time. They go to training every day. That's their full-time job. But they seem to be less obsessed with it than the people watching.
Yes.
As in, the players will actually get out there and they'll do the full-time training, they'll play the sport itself, they'll be focused on that in their entire full-time job, but then they'll go fishing or then they'll go do something else, whereas the people who turn up to the game every week are, watching everything obsessively and their whole life is based on this sports team
and
winning
or losing.
And then
go home and play fantasy football as well.
This is it. I think that's mirrored today with this thing called esports.
Yes.
Playing video games is now very lucrative. you win millions of dollars.
Right. You're very good, we should
If
say.
You're very good. And some teams are sponsored by huge companies.
Yes.
Where people get to go off and do their daily lives, live their daily lives.
Let's be clear. Esports means being a professional computer game player.
Yes, yes.
Playing a sport.
Yes. So they live their daily lives. They come back to a home that is provided for them, food provided for them, but they have to practice or train 8 hours a day to win these competitions. And companies are throwing money at this.
Yeah. I have a friend, I think I've mentioned this in a previous podcast, I have a friend who says when he looks at the cover of the game StarCraft, if he's got his Fitbit on, his heart rate goes up significantly just looking at the cover because it's such an intense game because he's played it at a higher level certainly than I have.
I think maybe it's helpful to draw some distinctions as well insofar as you can look at the content of the game, which is one issue. You've got people throwing money at this game, which is another whole issue, but also the internal disposition of the person playing the game. So
even
if you're playing at a professional level, but I think you're playing for the right reasons, so it's ordered to the right good of play, then I think you could say it's probably better than someone who's playing just because they're having money thrown at them. And then you could say, well, is it still a game at this point? Is something else going on?
Yes.
Is it just being sucked up into the corporate bureaucracy of
And I guess what I was
business.
Getting at there, linking it with Peter's earlier comment, is that I know a lot of my friends and some of my relatives spend almost all their free time watching these people play games. They're more invested in it, I think, than some of the players themselves.
That's absolutely ludicrous, Box. What they should be doing is watching some Date Island or whatever the latest I'm sorry, I'm really cynical about people who have a go at gamers. You spend all your time playing games. Well, you're watching some so-called reality show.
Or obsessed with the latest series on Netflix and binge it for 8 hours on end.
Yes, and I mean, people who have a go at me about role-playing but then watch Game of Thrones, you go, really? I don't watch Game of Thrones.
But I think there's the scope for that. Maybe we could talk about people have a willingness to be distracted.
Yes.
They really want to fill their time. And I think it's because
we're almost terrified of silence, aren't we?
Yeah. We don't want to sit alone with our own thoughts. It's too scary. It's too confronting. It is confronting. it's confronting for a lot of people.
I've seen parents take their kids out on a day out, but they're looking down at the screen the whole day. The kids are out there playing.
Tim Gaffigan has a line where he's talking about food, actually, but he says it's either that or feel my feelings.
I relate to that too much.
So let's bring it home in terms of our discussion of it. There are some games that are actually quite profoundly evil. There are several games which have been banned in Australia because they involve sexual violence, for example, predatory behaviour, and rightly so. They should have been banned.
Yes.
There are other games that were initially banned in Australia for their violent and even some of their sexual content, and one of them because it involved you participating in torture, but which have since been allowed to be played in Australia. I'm not going to name them because I don't want to give them a credit on this podcast, but I'm just saying what's interesting about them is that we initially didn't have an R rating for video games in Australia, and there was a lot of back and forth over whether we should have such a thing and whether or not adult games should be restricted to very seriously adult situations. The trouble is that the internet allows us access to everything.
Yes.
And so as soon as they say, let's ban this in Australia, it's irrelevant. And all of these people who want to push for internet filters, by the way, is another issue. Anybody with half a brain takes two steps and can get around a filter.
That's
all
right.
It does is slow down legitimate use of the internet. However, when they've actually looked at some of these games, the way to police them is to chase people down when they actually play them. So some of the games, for example, that are predatory, I suspect that the police would be watching anybody who's engaged with that kind of thing.
You
because
hope so.
Because it's specifically drawing you into a vice, even worse than a vice, a vile kind of mindset, a kind of thing. So when a game rewards you for being evil, when it consistently rewards you for being violent, for example, and I'm not talking about just fighting the bad guys, I'm talking about where corruption's involved. One particular game involves, you know, beating up prostitutes, having sex with various people, doing all sorts of evil things, and there's not really a reward for doing good things.
Yes.
And that's actually a problem in itself, I think. So some of the games they might have, for example, the Star Wars game I mentioned has the Sith, but the consequences of evil is that you suffer evil.
Yes, yeah. And you also have the choice as to what you do.
That's right. Whereas in a game which actually leads you into and channels you into evil actions, there's actually a problem there, I think, morally.
I think so too.
Hmm.
Yeah.
So, we haven't really touched on art because we've already touched on it in another episode, but the whole idea of experiencing a world that's different to ours isn't just about entering into a character. Sometimes it's about entering into a place. Mm. So we talked about entering the latest Assassin's Creed game, which has just an educational version of it, where you can just walk around ancient Egypt, walk into a tomb, an ancient tomb, and watch, you know, some of the most amazing scenes
play. And you actually play the role. There's different characters. And so you can go in as a priestess or or a commoner, and you actually view life from their point of view.
Right. And this has been an educational tool for some time. One of the earliest games was the Oregon Trail, which is a text game, and it was to attempt to get Americans to understand the hardships of the move west in the early Wild West. But nowadays they're finding that kids actually resonate with and actually learn much more from experiences where they're immersed into a situation. Mm. So you can go into a very old game called Second Life where you can walk around in 18th century Paris. And if somebody has gone to the trouble of recreating 18th century Paris, what's really cool about these online worlds is that when you get something like the Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris burnt down, there were two scans. One was an architectural scan, but the other scan, which they used to actually help recreate it, was a scan done by the game Assassin's Creed, who had scanned it with so much detail.
That's incredible.
It took one person a year to recreate the cathedral in the game. And it's so accurate.
That is beautiful. Yeah. Wow.
So there's a lot of helpful stuff. And what we've found also is that computer gaming, especially virtual reality, is now being used to treat and diagnose things such as schizophrenia, to deal with phobias, for example. You can actually create a situation where they approach phobias slightly differently. There's different ways in which we react to computer games. If my character, for example, in a game jumps off a height and falls, my stomach still reacts as if I'm falling. It's really bizarre, like I'm in a lift or something. Yeah. So there's an interaction we have with these worlds which can be used for good.
You have to say, I don't think gaming in of themselves are bad. Mm. I think we just have to draw distinctions from once we're within the game, and I think that's a really good place to start. They are good, and good can be done with them just as evil can be done with them, but like anything else in life, I think it can be used for good or bad.
Know
the limits, and also any medium, art or gaming or cultural things or music, promoting good, what's good, true and beautiful, good, true and beautiful. Right. And that means just as good plays, good art, good stories always have bad guys, occasionally, you know, we enter into that sort of thought pattern so we understand it better. But the ultimate thing is what does it do to you? How does it take you into a better place?
So something that maybe we could just finish with is Catholics and their role in gaming. I think so many Catholics, unfortunately, have the tendency to go the other extreme of saying gaming is really bad and we just shouldn't go there at all. But I think our faith is really one of trying to walk that golden mean. So I just think it could be a good idea just to finish and reflect on how Catholics can still be involved in gaming and bring goodness into this industry.
Be salt and light. Yeah. It's like saying, if you know, all people in sport are really brutal and ugly. Well, get some Catholics in there. Have them play with honour and dignity and give their absolute best, but at the same time be good sports. So in the same way, bringing salt and light to gaming.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very counter-cultural to the Catholic faith to see something and just something like gaming that's so entrenched in our culture and just go, I don't want to touch it.
Mm. Right.
I think we need to have a better look at it as believers so that we have a response, because more and more the kids that grow up from now on grow up with games and parents are addicted to, you know, Farmville or whatever it is on their phone.
Candy Crush.
Candy Crush. But,
and we need to have real responses for
and
this.
How do they answer their kids when the kids say, can I play Fortnite?
That's right.
You know, how do we talk about that sort of thing?
You say, it's inherently evil.
I mean, it used to be television. It used to be The Simpsons. Now it's video games.
Yeah.
And I think we need to broaden our studies and our looks on this topic.
And I think if we close ourselves out from it completely, we're just closing a window of opportunity of evangelization, of meeting people where they're at as well. So I think we need good Catholics who can game.
Mm.
Yes.
And have a lot of fun doing so.
Yes.
We're about wrapped up with that topic, I'd say. So now it's time for a segment we call 1 Minute Wonder. This is where we each share something that we've seen, heard, or experienced this week that's made us stop and wonder, something that made us smile or just appreciate life a little more. So in 1 minute, What's made you wonder recently, Ross?
Well, I've just recently spoken to a few couples that I know, and they're going through some very rough times, and myself as well recently. And I guess it made me reflect on just the attitude of gratefulness. I mean, we can focus on having this negative thing in our lives, but I found that they turned to an attitude of gratefulness and came much, much stronger for it, just being grateful for what we have and the time that we have it. And I think that really helped me in my faith, just being able to look at what I have, and it sort of gives me humility, brings me to humility. I know who I am again in relation to God. So, yeah, that really made me
wonder.
That's beautiful.
Tara. Yeah.
So one of my good friends, Will, shared a story with me yesterday, and it just really captured my heart and imagination. It's about Tolkien and a story about his wife, Edith. So apparently Tolkien met his wife when he was 16, and he fell in love with her deeply and was very smitten. But his priest actually told him, you're not allowed to speak to her for 5 years until you're 21 because you need to focus on your studies. Oh, and he listened.
Wow.
So he did not go there for 5 years, and apparently on the eve of his 21st birthday, he wrote her this long, massive love letter. There was a proposal. They were engaged a week later and they got married. And then apparently in his Silmarillion, which is the mythology of Lord of the Rings, the two main characters of the lovers that were really inspired Aragorn and Arwen in the series was actually inspired by his wife.
Aww.
Yes. And on their tombstones, they have the elvish names of those characters.
Beren and Luthien.
Beren and Luthien. Yes. And I just thought that was so beautiful, and what a way to capture the imagination.
Lovely. That's awesome. Mine is much more mundane. Someone tried a fraudulent transaction on my card from Malaysia, which means that my credit card got cancelled. And I'm now waiting for the new card to come. And I've realised I don't use cash anymore. Everything's on the card.
Those games that you pay for must be suffering.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's fine. I can do without games. What I can't do without is my Opal card's not going to get me to and from work. Yes. I can only actually, you know, do one more. I think I can get home today until my card comes. And also other things like you can't use cash to get on the train anymore.
No.
You can't use cash, to pay the bills anymore. You know, where do you go to pay the phone bill? Now everything's done online. And so if something's due, you kind of have to say, can you wait till Friday kind of thing? Because, that has to come in. The card has to come back to me. I've just realized how stuffed we would be if we lost out on these
internet
stuff, and also the credit that we've got. Really interesting. Anyway, that's it for this week's podcast. If today's discussion got you thinking or arguing with your podcast device, let us know. You can subscribe to the podcast on our website, thiscatholiclife.com.au. You can tell us what you liked, what you didn't like, what you'd like us to discuss in future by dropping us a line at info@thiscatholiclife.com.au, or you can tune into the conversation on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, or Discord, and all the links are in our show notes. Be sure to write us a review on iTunes. Remember that you have to be signed into the iTunes player. Find our show under podcast and then leave a review. Make sure you actually write a review. Don't just leave the 5 stars. Remember that this is a uniquely Australian Catholic podcast. We think that's a great idea, an idea worth getting behind. So tell your friends. Before we go, it's time for shout-outs.
Yes, to all those who are suffering at the moment, it's been a difficult month for me and several other people, and I know that in those difficult times, it can be one of those things that faith just slips away.
Okay.
And just for those people, shout-out to you guys. I hope that you're going stronger, you know?
Okay.
So I have a shout out for just a particular group of people: Annetta, Irene, Natalie, Chloe, Will, Daniel and Cronin. Thank you for being amazing friends and really showing me what it means to be part of a Catholic community.
Awesome. My shout out is to my long suffering wife as I'm going through marking season at Notre Dame. Yeah. It's she has to put up with me being at home and grinding my way through many hundreds of papers. That's all for now. Thank you for listening to This Catholic Life.